So this morning I want to continue in this vein, and I want to help set the scene for discussing issues around violent extremist offenders in prison and probation contexts. Now I'm here because I authored this paper with the Rand Center of Excellence, and it was a very exciting opportunity and a very challenging opportunity, as this line of work is changing almost on a monthly basis, it seems, and so it's difficult to keep up. My day job is, as Ramin said, is at the University of Cambridge. I'm a researcher there. And so what I've done over the past, I've been in England for about 9 years now, what I've done at Cambridge is looked at violent extremism from preventative angles over this course of time. I've also worked in prison settings for about 3 or 4 years, interviewed lots of offenders who've been convicted for terrorist-related offenses, about 15. And I've also more recently worked in probation settings. So I come at this from both as a author and a collaborator with the Radicalization Awareness Network and as a researcher. And so I hope you will excuse that as I deliver this presentation, I will bring in some of my own research, but I'm going to do it only to illustrate the major points that were demonstrated through this paper. I think sometimes having stories is really important to anchor some of the concepts. So I'll be telling you some stories anonymously, of course, with important details changed, to help drive home some of these themes that have been talked about all morning this morning. So let's position this paper, first of all, alongside the other papers. First of all, it's smaller, and we intentionally made it smaller. It's something you can read over at lunch hour. We hope that you can skim and return to, but also read alongside the other incredibly useful handbooks. And I think what's encouraging so far is that we all agree. There's absolutely nothing that I disagree with my co-panelists, so that's good. Now, our aim in this working paper was to provide frontline staff and policymakers with an overview of current practices and issues relevant to managing violent extremist offenders. And what we wanted to do was to inform decision-making processes. And now another aim of the paper was to speak to different European Union member states. And so this involves speaking to very different practices, very different contexts across the European Union. I'm not sure if we were able to succeed with that, but that, I think, is always hoped for in the third version. But that is a set aim of the paper. And I think it raises questions about the language of best practices, especially in view of the fact that these are all emerging practices. But we do hope that we were able to identify some of emerging good practices within these emergent practices. And I'll speak to some of those as I go along. Now, what I wanted to do most in this paper was to provide you with a way of thinking about radicalization in prisons. I don't think we can provide answers at this stage, and I think we want to do more than just suggest questions. And so we've provided a way of thinking, about the set of issues and how entangled they are and how messy they can be from a practitioner point of view and from a policy point of view, and also a way of thinking that encourages flexibility and adaptability, and a way of thinking that is part of an ongoing learning experience, one that is guided by the most robust principles in human rights. And as I said, I'm encouraged that this paper is the second edition, which means that we'll have another iteration where we can develop it further, and these are all works in progress. So what I want to do this morning, before we get into questions, which is where the really exciting part happens, is to draw on this paper and give you some examples from my own research to illustrate the principles at work here. So we had a few guiding principles as refined in the report. The first is that a safe society is ensured through promoting the well-being and rehabilitation of offenders. So if we think of security today, we need to be thinking of promoting the well-being of offenders. And also another principle is that terrorism crimes are unequal. As Philip has said, that not all terrorist acts are the same. And of course, this has come up with the different forms of terrorism legislation that is covering a broader remit of offenses. And so you have people in prison who've never committed an act of violence who may have been involved in fundraising. And thirdly, we maintain a belief that offenders are capable of positive change. And so there's this belief that offenders can change, even those with hardened viewpoints. And finally, we maintain the fundamentals of universal human rights and that these must be upheld at all times. One second. We'll get to the right PowerPoint here. So there we are. Second slide. So this is the context. These figures need updating, which is a good thing because we're working on the next version. As you can see from that very small diagram, obviously the context involves travel to Syria and now returning foreign fighters. This has been discussed by my co-panelists. Big questions around the best way for reintegration, whether legal means are necessary. And part of the context also involves recognizing that extremism and radicalization takes a range of forms. It's not simply Islamist radicalization. Actually, right-wing extremism is growing in different areas, but this is often masked in figures on terrorism because often these crimes are prosecuted under hate crime legislation or different forms of legislation other than terrorism legislation. But I think it makes us aware that this is a whole society problem. This is a global problem. And it reminds us of how fragile our societies are, that our societies can be polarized. And particularly within a prison environment, and I'll give you some examples of this, our societies, our prison societies can become polarized, and that can really undermine rehabilitative efforts, and it can increase the risks of radicalization. And so the paper is structured into two parts. We look very bluntly at questions related to prison environment and questions related to the probation environment, even though that distinction isn't maintained necessarily across European Union member states, but we did that for practical reasons. And we also have included in the paper two types of boxes. That's an overview. Two types of boxes, which are digi-memo. These are sort of tantalizing boxes, as you can see from this one. We explore questions around legitimacy and what the importance of legitimacy for running a prison and for countering radicalization. And so here, both a fair and transparent process and fair outcomes are important. And I think this also reflects the need for scrutiny of our processes. And I don't think this was mentioned by my co-panelists, that there needs to be scrutiny of processes that are in place so that those processes can be modified, adapted, and reformed ultimately. Now, other blue boxes throughout this paper point out, as my co-panelists have, that there's sometimes technical jargon. So we have de-radicalization, disengagement. Sometimes this language is helpful. Sometimes it isn't helpful. Sometimes it stops us from seeing different ways of recognizing the issues. Sometimes just plain questions around supporting prisoners, supporting offenders, leads us to the same ends. And sometimes the language of radicalization can actually do more harm than good, particularly when monitoring for radicalization. And so I encourage you to read that. We also include slides summarizing key recommendations. And we begin with a discussion of the first line of defense when it comes to radicalization. And this is a healthy prison environment. Now, this is drawn from research, as was mentioned, particularly that of Mark Hams, who observed that prison radicalization is uneven. So that means that not all prisons generate the same amount of anger and alienation, or that willing or enabling of radicalization. In fact, there are particular forms of prison climates that are more susceptible to radicalization. And this is very important. And so a healthy prison environment is one with good staff-prisoner relationships, one where prisoners are treated with dignity and respect and courtesy at all times. And it is these day-to-day interactions that make the first line of defense. And building trust is crucial. I'm reminded of one very inspiring prison officer who told me how Each day, he said to one particular prisoner, good morning. And the prisoner would never make eye contact. He would never say good morning back. And 2 years later, the prisoner finally broke down and he said good morning back. And this is the type of day-to-day struggle that prison officers are involved in building trust. And that's quite crucial. And that's often lost in these broader discussions of policy and best practice. But it's these day-to-day interactions which may make all the difference. And it contributes to a positive prison culture. And as you may or may not know, at the Institute of Criminology in Cambridge, Professor Alison Liebling has developed a measure to look at the ways that prison environments can be measured to either promote human flourishing or that might incapacitate human flourishing. And that measure is called the measure of the quality of prison life. And so that's being used across the UK as a measurement of prison cultures in general. And it just reinforces the importance of being able to measure and understand how well prisons are performing when it comes to questions around dignity and humanity and respect. And safety is another key element here. And I just want to tell you another brief story about risk and safety and how these are often entangled. And often it's taken as a fact that violent extremist offenders convicted for terrorist-related offenses going into prison are going to be a risk to others. But actually what has happened in a number of cases is that these might be first-time offenders and they're suddenly thrust into a new environment and forced to adapt. And sometimes that means upping up their identity, sometimes that means joining up with the biggest group. And so there is a certain vulnerability associated with violent extremist prisoners, and safety needs to be put on the forefront. And so I'm thinking of two cases here. One prisoner who was, both of these cases were thrust into a high security prison, never having been in prison before, and one ended up joining a bigger group and ended up being attacking another prisoner and getting charged for that, for assault. And then another prisoner was in a situation where he was about to be pressured into making an attack. And what ended up happening was that the prison was very mindful of his safety and they ended up extracting him from that situation, pulling him into safety. And so safety is really crucial here, and vulnerability and risk often go hand in hand. And safety is the underlying principle here. The next section of our paper explores risk assessment and support, and I think you're going to hear much more about this from people who know much more about this than myself, so I will leave that to them. But we do suggest that frequent assessments are very important, that assessments going into prison, especially for mental health, are also very important. And we also discuss some of the significance of intelligence gathering and intelligence sharing, as has been mentioned. And so it's very important that intelligence is shared widely. But the quality of intelligence is very important as well. We've talked about dynamic security. And I'm thinking here, can I get a show of hands? If this was a piece of intelligence that ran across your desk, how many are alarmed? Can I have hands? Are you alarmed by this, if this intelligence came across your desk from a prisoner? One person is alarmed. Really? Okay, lots of people, okay, five people are alarmed. My point here is that when I heard this prisoner speak this, for intelligence, this is about as risky and scary as you can get. But the context was very important. What was happening when this prisoner exclaimed this in a closed space was that there were some things going on in the prisons that were developing tensions between Muslim prisoners and staff. And there was a move where the religious headdress, the shemay, was banned just within that prison, and it caused an outrage. It caused an outrage on two fronts. First, because it was part of the human rights related to religious provision, and that angered people. And it also angered people because it was seen as a direct assault on Islam. And so here you can see that there's a much broader context around this piece of intelligence. And what is needed is that sort of contextualization. And so here's the description of the allowance for this religious headdress in the UK. And so you can see why that made people angry and why he used that. And so that context is very important. We've also discussed today bigger questions around what to do with people who are convicted for violent extremist offenses, and what to do with people who are at risk of radicalization. And this has been framed in terms of the dispersal concentration model. We've developed this flowchart, which may seem overwhelming at first, but if you think through it, it kind of makes sense. But it suggests that there is a third option, and that is a blend of the two. And so people may come into the dispersal mode, but they may then be flagged for various concerns and then enter the concentration model. So you do get a hybrid approach as well. And I think that these approaches on the ground are what social scientists call ideal types. And so on the ground, they may not map onto this well, because in practice things are a lot more fluid. But I think this diagram does a good job of discussing some of the major decision-making processes that need to be made. Things like, what are the entrance criteria for bringing people into a segregated unit? What are the exit criteria? How do people get out of there? What happens post-release? These sorts of things need to be considered beforehand. We also discuss in this paper the difference between specialist and non-specialist interventions, and the need. This may take the form of theological interventions, and we're going to hear some of that tomorrow, which I'm excited for. It may be psychologically based interventions, and we'll hear more about that later as well. Or it might use more imaginative means. And I have in mind here one offender who told me in the community setting how he started to have a love for art, and he started to be involved in an art program. And one of the programs allowed him to take his art, and it was exhibited within a place in London, a gallery in London. And this became a very profound sense of identity for him that allowed him to move forward and to do something constructive. And so using thinking outside of the box and ways that we can help to enable people to become better people and to change themselves through things like art. And so rehabilitation interventions can take a variety of means. We've also discussed staff training. This is very crucial. And I just want to add to this that faith awareness training, cultural awareness training, is very important. But I think having transparent processes and training opportunities for equality training is quite crucial to make sure the complaint procedures are transparent. This is very important moving forward. And of course, frontline staff need support, as this is incredibly hard work. Moving now to the probation side, and I'm still good for time. We know less about the probation context. Again, there are fewer offenders who've been released than are going into prison. There's not a lot of joined up research in this area. And so I'll give you a few stories that I think are helpful. And I just gave the one example of the prisoner who participated in the art program, and that was quite inspirational. But in terms of the probation officer, reflecting on the role of the probation officer, and this isn't related to violent extremism specifically, but I think it has a great importance for thinking about the role of the probation officer. This quote is a bit difficult to read, but what he's saying is that the probation officer serves as a bridge between the state and the offender. And so there's someone in between. They fight on the side of the offender, and they criticize the state, very interestingly. They can be critical of the state and the injustices and the harms that may have been done while in prison. But also the probation officer serves as a mentor and a guide that helps the offender to rebuild their lives. And so they have a very unique role, and he describes this as helping the polity of the offender, to help the offender become a citizen once again. It's sort of a helping hand, a link along the way. And we discuss some of this in the report. I'm thinking of watching very inspirational probation officers recently. One of them was needing to do a risk assessment for an offender who was just released from prison. And the probation officer knew this individual very well, and he knew that this risk assessment for violent extremism was bogus. It was made up. It didn't have much substance to it. And so what I witnessed in their interaction was this probation officer saying, "This is what is required of me to help you move along. Can we join up? Can we think about doing this together just to get through it? I know you're not an extremist, this is silly, but how can we do this together?" And it's that form of trust building that is so crucial to both risk management and developing trust that ultimately enables offenders to regain their lives in society as citizens. And I've also witnessed the opposite happen. I've seen a risk assessment that was being done on a probationer, someone in probation services. He found out and he completely disengaged from probation services. And he was very angry. He wouldn't talk, he wouldn't make eye contact. I haven't followed up with him. He may have been recalled, I'm not sure. But it can go either way. So it shows how delicate this is and how important trust is. And alongside trust, and these illustrations that I've given you, what we provide in terms of clear guidance is to have resettlement plans. So anticipating at least 6 months in advance how our offender is going to be supported post-release, looking at family ties, looking at friendship networks, looking at jobs, employment, these sorts of things. Because we know that there are massive barriers to reentry for prisoners in general, for offenders in general, but especially for people convicted for violent extremism or at risk of radicalization. One prisoner described to me how painful his experience in prison was. He said, described it as a scar when he was put into a foreign national prison when he was actually a British citizen. So we have a lot of work to do here if these are the types of experiences and wounds that need healing. One practitioner commented on the difficulty of managing risk in the community with violent extremist offenders. He said that the problem is that if you make the wrong decision as a practitioner, then the decision comes from very high up and you're in a lot of trouble. So it's very difficult to get this balance between allowing offenders to have a bit more leeway and to rehabilitate, and yet sort of keeping them on a tight rein. A very difficult balance. So I want to conclude with three points going forward. The first is an encouragement for venues like this and the ones that my colleagues have talked about across European Union member states, and that's sharing of best practices and having this shared publicly in a way that builds up a bigger picture of what is working well in this area. And I think for the next iteration of this report, what's needed is a table that just shows different member states and sort of the practical things and practical models that are being employed. We weren't able to achieve that last time. My second point of reflection is the need for scrutiny. As I mentioned earlier, it's important that all of these developing processes have built in a process for transparency and scrutiny. So we can learn from mistakes, so we can build on good practice, and so we can ultimately reform this area. And related to this, and thirdly, I would just like to say that, of course, as a researcher, I would argue that more research is needed in this area, particularly those following offenders from prison post-release, and the ways that offenders are able to ultimately rebuild their lives. And just to close with a brief story about an offender that I interviewed about 3 or 4 years after he was released from prison. And he working. He had a brother who came to visit him quite frequently at his work, and we met around his work, and we went into a cafe, and the cafe owner knew him quite well, and the drink was free for me because they knew each other so well, they had developed that bond. And I was asking him my interview questions as usual, and one of my questions is the sort of bizarre one about, do you feel like you belong in society? And that can go one of two ways. People can be like, well, why are you asking me? That's a silly question. But he thought about it and he reflected. And he said, well, yes, I'm just part of the furniture now. And so the amazing thing about this work is that if it works well, actually people recede into the woodwork and you don't notice them anymore. And so this is a tale of hope, I think, for us all. Thank you.